Okay, welcome to the 21st RVC podcast, Veterinary Science on the Move. My name is Mark Cleesby, and I'm taking over interviewing duties from Matthias, who's taking a well-earned break. At this stage, I just thought I'd also like to thank the contribution not only of Matthias, who really got this program off the ground, but also the valuable technical assistance of the eMedia unit, specifically Brian Cox, in bringing these to you. Anyway, today we're going to be talking to Professors Ken Smith and Josh Slater about equine herpes virus. So today I'm here with Professors Ken Smith and Josh Slater to talk about the scourge that is equine herpes virus infection. So first up, Josh, what should owners or vets be looking for in order to recognise equine herpes virus infection?
This is a respiratory infection, so the route of entry into the horse is the respiratory tract, but the sequelae from that, specifically abortion and neurological disease, are the major clinical signs, and clinically obvious respiratory disease from EHV1 is not very common, but outbreaks have been recorded. So probably the first warning that many owners would get would be a mare that aborts, and of particular concern in both Europe and in the USA, a horse that develops signs of paralysis.
Okay, so it's not something that manifests primarily as a respiratory disease then?
No, in most cases not, although the respiratory tract is the route by which the virus gains entry into the horse. What actually happens is that following initial replication in the respiratory tract, the virus quickly invades and establishes a cell-associated viremia, which distributes virus all around the horse. And at certain stages of pregnancy, and I'm sure Ken will talk about this later, mares are very susceptible to herpes virus-induced damage to the blood vessels in the uterus and the placenta, causing abortion. And similarly, viremia distributes virus to the nervous system, which can lead to injury to endothelium in the nervous system and a paralysis as a result.
And does this paralytic disease then arise at the same sort of time as an abortive outbreak, or do these manifest in totally different disease syndromes?
Well, the pregnant mares which abort may then go on and develop paralysis. Many of the big outbreaks of paralysis which have occurred in the USA in particular have been in livery yards and groups of riding horses where there have been no pregnant mares about. But you can certainly see situations of abortion and paralysis, but most commonly, because of the different uses that horses have, outbreaks of paralytic disease tend to occur in groups of riding horses.
So in this situation where you're confronted with a mare aborting, how complicated is it to confirm a diagnosis of EHV?
Thank you, Mark. Picking up on Josh's point about the protean nature of the infection and the way that it can present as a neurological disease or an abortogenic disease and initially acquired as a respiratory infection, that informs the way that we diagnose the infection. So in relation to the abortogenic disease, what we would wish to do is to recover infectious virus or to demonstrate virus-infected cells in the aborted fetus or in the placenta. And we would do that by virus isolation in cell culture or increasingly nowadays by the PCR to amplify small amounts of viral DNA from those materials. One cavil to make in relation to the abortogenic disease at this stage is that there is now quite good evidence from field studies that in not all cases of equine herpes virus abortion is the fetus infected, and we'll say a little bit more about this in relation to mechanisms, but in some cases these abortions are principally due to damage on the maternal side of the placenta rather than the fetal side of the placenta. And there's currently interest, therefore, in looking at endometrial biopsy and other means of diagnosing those atypical equine herpes virus abortions. In relation to the neurological disease diagnosis, unfortunately, speaking as a pathologist, often comes into the pathology ward rather than the internal medicine ward, in the sense that very often that diagnosis has to be confirmed post-mortem after an animal has been destroyed with neurological signs. And what we would aim to do there would be to amplify viral DNA from the central nervous system, or to identify virus-infected cells from the central nervous system. The other means of diagnosing the paralytic disease, though, would be to look at horses in contact with an animal showing neurological signs to demonstrate either seroconversion, high levels of antibody to the virus, or, as Josh has alluded to, circulating white blood cells in the bloodstream of in-contact horses that indicate an infection circulating on the premises. And I think the last point I'd make in relation to diagnosis is this is a disease which, by virtue of its complexity, does behoves us that clinicians and laboratory diagnosticians work very closely together in making this diagnosis.
And I think the question about diagnosing the paralytic case is a very important one, because from a clinical point of view, when presented with a horse with neurological signs, and there's a concern it might be EHV, which for most people has risen right to the top of the differential list because of the high awareness of the problem, it is actually a real issue, because, as you say, the full confirmation really only is possible at post-mortem exam. But I think it's worth reminding ourselves that the initial clinical signs in most outbreaks are definitely not respiratory disease. So the old idea that there'd be a warning with horses with perhaps nasal discharge or coughing or other respiratory signs isn't the case. And experience in many outbreaks now suggests that the only warning clinical sign would be fever, pyrexia. And this would precede onset of neurological disease by a few days. And that when these animals are showing neurological clinical signs, they probably will have sera converted. So a rapid horse-side serological test like the GG ELISA, for example, might be of value in horses which have not been vaccinated. Clearly, vaccination would make interpretation difficult. And some of these animals will be shedding virus, and we'll probably touch on PCR diagnosis later on, I think, but this would be an indication for rapid diagnosis of virus DNA by either a conventional or a real-time PCR method.
Okay, so I mean, obviously, this is a disease that can result in a number of undesirable clinical syndromes, but what's the strategy then for dealing with an outbreak, and on an individual basis, I guess, how effectively can one treat the infection once it's diagnosed?
In respect of strategy for dealing with the outbreak, the principal thing that one needs to remember with herpes viruses, and Josh will say more about this in relation to how the viruses persist, is that these are not diseases that we can eradicate from horse populations. A large proportion of horses carry these infections. So in terms of controlling outbreaks, I think the important points to remember as veterinary surgeons is that we should be able to diagnose the first or the early cases of disease quickly and specifically. And we should then be using measures to limit the spread of infection horse to horse after that index case or after the early cases. So to give the example of the disease on a stud farm with an abortogenic presentation, what we would aim to do is to have an abortion on a stud farm investigated thoroughly and quickly, and the diagnosis then made, and then that pregnant mare, and particularly the products of abortion, removed from her in contacts to limit any horse-to-horse transmission of infection, remembering that herpes viruses, by their nature, do require close contact between animals to spread, and are unlike influenza virus or foot-and-mouth disease virus in the sense that they don't tend to aerosolize over long distances. So the very simple measures of dividing at-risk horses into smaller groups may quite significantly limit the spread of infection from group to group and from horse to horse. Josh, I don't know if you would enlarge upon that.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of detailed thought gone into those principles, and these have been embodied in the Horse Race Betting Levy Board's code of practice for herpes virus control, and there is a similar protocol available through the American Association of Equine Practitioners and their infection control group. And both protocols really try and establish three main principles, which is to limit the spread of infection on the affected premises, and the measures that Ken was just talking about really relate to them. And then second, to take measures to reduce the risk of accidentally spreading infection from those premises to other premises, and then finally making sure that when the infection appears to be over, that the outbreak actually truly has finished. And the detailed package of measures, and I think it's probably better not to run through all those now, but are available for download from the Horse Race Betting Levy Board website, which is hblb.org.uk, and really explains in detail how those three broad goals would be achieved.
So this is not a notifiable disease, but obviously there's a great deal of concern and a lot of measures therefore in place to prevent it becoming established if it does come in an outbreak.
Yes, I think the question of notifiable status is very interesting. There are a number of people who would feel that it would be a great assistance to disease surveillance and control to have more of the equine diseases, and I think many people would include the herpes viruses in that, and also strangles infection, streptococcus equi. But you're quite right, Mark, these are not notifiable diseases, and I think there's no realistic possibility of other equine diseases being added to the notifiable list. So we do have an informal, so non-compulsory system for reporting the occurrence of equine infectious disease, which is coordinated through the Animal Health Trust in Newmarket. And these summaries of disease occurrence are published on a quarterly basis through the assistance of DEFRA and Beaver, and these are available online and also appear in the veterinary record. And these give us an insight into what's happening across the UK, but it's not a complete story, and there will be, I'm sure, outbreaks and individual cases of disease which occur which are not reported.
And presumably in a lot of parts of the world this is an endemic disease?
Absolutely. In fact, herpes viruses are very well adapted to mammals as a group and appear to have co-evolved with mammals. And I think I'm right in saying that I think every mammal that's been examined has
a herpes virus.
Yeah.
Yes,
okay.
Interestingly.
And in terms of being a successful parasite, herpes viruses have evolved very successfully to live with horses, and I think every population of horses which has been examined carries herpes virus infections, and this includes things like Przewalski's horses living as feral herds, and so this really is an example of an old pathogen which has co-evolved with its host to adopt really a very sophisticated lifestyle in virus terms, and something which ensures the virus spread. Something that we touched on earlier that is worth mentioning here is a particular feature of the virus life cycle, which is latency. And I think we're all very familiar with the story with the human herpes viruses, with cold sores and with chickenpox and shingles. These are very common examples of virus infections which persist in an absolute silent form in us for many years, probably for our entire life, and periodically virus becomes active again and causes clinical disease. And this is a common feature for all of the herpes viruses studied, and EHV1 is no exception. And probably every single horse which meets virus, and remember most horses meet virus in their first few weeks or months of life, develop whatever clinical disease signs they show and then carry virus in a latent form probably for the rest of their lives. And we know a little bit about this. It's carried in circulating lymphocytes, in particular T lymphocytes, and it's also it's carried in parts of the nervous system in the trigeminal ganglion, which is responsible for providing sensation to the nasal cavity. And virus persists in both those sites, and periodically, particularly in times of stress, and we have a little bit of the data about this in relation to transport stress and going to shows, for example, which does result in horses shedding virus. This virus becomes active, and the result of this reactivation is the shedding once again of infectious virus from that horse's respiratory tract. And this might then, of course, infect other horses in the group. Or if the horse's immune system is not able to deal with that newly active virus, perhaps the re-establishment of a whole new cycle of infection in that horse, which could result in abortion or paralysis. And I think if I had to choose one feature of this virus that accounted for its globally successful distribution throughout the horse population, it's this ability to persist in this silent form. These horses look clinically normal. It's very difficult. So even using molecular methods, it's very difficult to confidently identify latently infected horses, although the very sensitive PCR techniques, particularly real-time PCR, are capable of identifying horses that carry latent virus genome. And I guess my final point is that when these horses are reactivating, to start with at least, they are generally clinically normal. So it's a normal horse at a show, which is shedding infectious virus and will infect others.
Yes, and I guess that's probably the most scary aspect of the virus then, in terms of its control, and I guess re-emphasises the importance of vaccination as a control method for this disease. Now, my understanding certainly is that the majority of horses in the UK are vaccinated, but I mean, what is the vaccination protocol, and how effective is it currently in the control of the disease?
Yes, well, it certainly is the case that the majority, certainly of bloodstock, of thoroughbreds, will be vaccinated against the abortogenic disease. The current vaccines available commercially in the United Kingdom are inactivated vaccines, so the virus has been killed in the laboratory. And those inactivated vaccines, like other inactivated vaccines, have the disadvantage that whereas they will stimulate the horse to produce antibodies against the infection, they tend not to stimulate the horse to a good cell-mediated immune response. So they tend not to stimulate T cells to proliferate in response to that infection. And that's important in relation to herpes viruses, because as Josh has mentioned, one of the ways that this virus persists in horses and causes disease in horses is that after it infects a horse, or when it reactivates within a horse, it very quickly becomes intracellular within white blood cells circulating in the bloodstream, and therefore shielded against antibody for the most part. So the consequence of that, practically speaking, is that the inactivated vaccines that we use are certainly beneficial in reducing the length of time over which an infected horse will shed virus from the nasal cavity, and so the length of time over which that horse is a risk potentially to its in contacts. But current evidence would suggest that those inactivated vaccines are not effective against reactivation from latency in the individual horse. And I think much of the excitement, therefore, comes in dissecting down to the mechanisms of the disease and trying to identify which genes and which proteins of the virus enable the virus quickly to become intracellular, for example, or quickly to infect the central nervous system, which I think we shall discuss in more detail as our discussion progresses.
Well, I think one of the questions that always comes up when you think about vaccination is, if I vaccinate my latently infected horse, will that then eliminate the latent infection? And we know quite a lot about what happens in latently infected cells in horses and in other animals, and the virus essentially is inactive. There's very limited gene transcription and no translation of that mRNA, so these latently infected cells do not express virus proteins, which of course means they are invisible to the immune system. So I think it's unrealistic to expect any vaccine, whether it's a current generation or a future generation vaccine, to control latency. But as Ken alluded to, we could expect an effective vaccine to try to limit the consequences of reactivation, and specifically that would require having effective levels of mucosal immunity, both antibody and ideally cell-mediated immunity at the mucosal surface, so that when reactivating virus is delivered to the mucosa, it's neutralised, or if it succeeds in infecting cells, those virus-infected cells are killed. And, of course, if we think about current delivery routes for the European vaccines, which are all inactivated vaccines delivered intramuscularly, those vaccines have very limited potential for inducing mucosal immunity. and we'll probably talk a little bit about how we'd like to deliver our future vaccines in a few minutes. But I think in the context of latency and reactivation, it's very important that vaccines do stimulate effective mucosal immunity.
I suppose one of the other challenges then to making vaccines is the fact that there are multiple strains of the virus. So, I mean, how do the different disease entities relate to the identities of the different strains of the viruses, and do the vaccines manage to cover all of these?
Thank you, Mike. This is a particularly interesting and, I think, exciting area of current research. It's been known for some time that, as we've been saying today, EHV1 causes different disease syndromes, but until recently it was very difficult to associate particular strains of virus with those particular syndromes. And the excitement recently is that it has recently been demonstrated that those strains of EHV1 which cause the neurological disease that we're also concerned about as horse owners and breeders and veterinary surgeons do have a genetic difference which is detectable from those strains of virus which do not cause the neurological disease, which observation then enables us theoretically to do two things in the relatively short term, which would be firstly to develop diagnostic tests which specifically detect those highly virulent, potentially neuropathogenic strains of EHV1, for example, while they're reactivating or while they're subclinical in an animal before there are any clinical signs of the neurological disease, and to put isolation precautions in place. And the observation also enables us in respect of vaccination to theoretically develop modified live rather than inactivated vaccines against EHV1 from which that sequence, which appears to be associated with the more severe complications of the infection, has been deleted. And I think in relation to EHV1 research, it will be following along those lines of inquiry which will potentially revolutionise control of this infection in the next decade.
I mean, I think I completely agree, Ken. I think there's a remarkable discovery. Here's a virus with, you know, a large genome by virus, standards 155 kb, encoding 76 different open reading frames, and it's remarkable that dimorphism in one of those open reading frames has such a good correlation with the ability to cause neurological disease. You know, I would have confidently predicted, if I didn't know that, this would be a polygenic trait, and yet it seems that we have this single dimorphism which either directly or indirectly is responsible for being able to induce neurological disease.
Well, that sounds like a really key point. So, I mean, with these findings with regard to the genetic complementation of the virus, what sort of information does this then give us about how the virus is causing its disease, the mechanisms of infection, basically?
Yes, well, this is the excitement, really, of those data, because now that we understand at the molecular level how different genes and potentially different proteins of EHV1 operate, we can translate that back to the effect of the virus on tissues. And it's been known for some little time now, for perhaps 20 years, that EHV1, as a virus which causes neurological disease, causes that disease by damaging blood vessels in the central nervous system. And indeed, the early research work on that infection, which was done here at the Royal Veterinary College by Neil Eddington and his colleagues, likened the disease to an equine stroke, in the sense that the virus replicated in the endothelial cells, the cells lining blood vessels within the brain and particularly within the spinal cord, causing blood clotting or thrombosis to occur within those blood vessels, the consequence of which within the central nervous system is very serious, because individual areas of the central nervous system generally only receive their oxygenated blood supply from a small number of blood vessels, and if those blood vessels are compromised, then the area of tissue supplied dies and the animal presents with a neurological deficit. More recently, other research in Newmarket and parallel research in the United States has shown that the abortogenic disease, surprisingly but gratifyingly, has a very similar vascular mechanism. So once more, in the late pregnant uterus of mares, where blood vessels are infected with EHV1, again those blood vessels undergo thrombosis, so clots form within the blood vessel. And the consequences of that for the pregnancy are profound, in the sense that if a very large proportion of blood vessels within the pregnant uterus undergo thrombosis, that vascular compromise can be so severe that the pregnancy is lost before the fetus becomes infected. And this was the presentation I was alluding to earlier of an atypical EHV1 abortion. Whereas the more usual situation is that smaller numbers of blood vessels become thrombosed, but then that event, local tissue death, allows virus to leak across the placental barrier, infect the unborn fetus, and then to multiply within the fetus, causing abortion. So I think the way to take forward our understanding of the molecular events in the infection are to try and make that next mental step of trying to establish whether, if we delete particular genes from EHV1, are we able to block, for example, the infection of the white blood cell that delivers the virus to the endothelial cell? Or can we perhaps block infection of the endothelial cell or block thrombosis following on from that infection?
And we've mentioned viremia a few times now. It really is a key step in pathogenesis. And if I were choosing one thing I wanted a vaccine to control, it would be viremia. And it's perhaps just worth adding to the points Kenneth just made that George Allen's group in Kentucky have recently shown that the feature of these highly pathogenic viruses that cause neurological disease is that they cause a high level of viremia, which continues for a long time in comparison to the viruses which don't cause neurological disease.
And I guess really the key question then is, with all these exciting new molecular findings, is this now going to be able to inform a new generation of vaccines that will be more effective in controlling each of the presentations, I guess?
That will be, I think, the hope that we all have, that yes, the new molecular data will inform vaccination. What we would hope to do is to identify those genes which can be deleted from an EHV1 virus in order to abolish the most serious consequences of the infection. So if particularly we can delete the genes that enabled the virus to infect blood vessels within the central nervous system, but at the same time retain those genes that stimulate a robust cell-mediated immune response to the infection. The paradox in relation to this virus and in relation to its ability to persist, I think this is important, however, is that in some cases those genes are one and the same. So the genes which enable the virus to infect particular cell types may also be the genes which are the most immunogenic in respect of the viral protein.
And it may just be worth adding as a concluding remark that one of the safe approaches to vaccination, which might be an alternative track to using live attenuated vaccines, would be to use subunit vaccines, proteins, which would stimulate immunity. And it's becoming clear that we also need to take into account the horse if we're going to consider protein vaccines, because the genotype of the horse determines which virus epitopes are presented by particular MHC molecules, and this is, I'd say, a level of complexity to protein vaccination which I think was probably predicted, but I think has been a surprise to everyone working with it. But the good news is that we now have the equine genome project completed, so it's a much more realistic goal to understand the equine MHC and all of its genetic variants than it would have been 10 years ago.
Okay, well, that sounds like a really optimistic note on which to end our very stimulating discussion. Thank you very much, Josh and Ken.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for listening to the latest edition of the RVC podcast. We'll be very pleased to hear from you if you have any suggestions for future topics or any comments to be made on the existing podcasts. And you can contact us by email at podcast@rvc.ac.uk. I'll look forward to speaking to you next time on our next podcast transmission.